Hello and welcome to Dragon Years, Remembrance of Times Past 2024, the final episode of a special series that has discussed Dohwa's milestone years since 2000. In this episode, Dohwa Executive Director John Kam talks with board member and seasoned diplomat Bill McCahill on the way US-China relations played out in 2024 and how that impacted Dohwa's work. I began by asking Bill and John how they came to know each other.
I met John in Hong Kong in probably 1976 when I was in the consulate and John was just starting his business and running back and forth to the Canton Trade Fair and so on. Although we might have crossed paths before that since we grew up on the New Jersey shore in towns about 3 miles apart. And John's reputation, of course, preceded him, but it might not have crossed the bridge into Allenhurst. In any event, I went to Beijing and then eventually to Washington and Western Europe and Canada and finally back to Scandinavia in my foreign service posting. So I didn't get back to Beijing until the summer of 1996. But much had changed. I mean, the Tiananmen killings, of course, right in the middle of that period. That period, 96 through 2000, was quite a productive one for U.S.-China relations, as well as for Dohwa's work, with lots of peaks and lots of valleys. From the WTO accession, not months before that, there had been a NATO bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, as you remember. But we had two state visits, Jiang Zemin to the U.S. and Bill Clinton to China. And then the official visit of Zhu Rongji, who was the premier of the State Council in the spring of 99. And of course, just towards the end of that, my period, John's work was sort of reorganized into the foundation.
So I've known Bill, as he says, for a long time. His Chinese skills are incredible. Also, he's too modest to admit to this, but he is what we call a polyglot. He's able to learn languages very quickly. He went to Norway to be our number two in the embassy, and Norwegian was very good. Some of you may know who are listening, we have over the years gotten support, grants from Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and even Finland. I have to tell this story before we launch into more substantive things, if you will. Bill and I go to Helsinki, and we stayed in a hotel. What is it called? The Cam Hotel or something?
Kampf Hotel, I think, yes.
So we took the opportunity to wander around, and it turns out that in Finland, they cull the bears once a year. We found out that there is something called the Bear Restaurant, and we went to the Bear Restaurant, and there we ate some bear. That could open up a whole chain of discussion, which we won't do today.
I'm glad you mentioned the, not only our exploits in Helsinki, but, you know, when I was posted to the embassy in Oslo, it was just kind of the serendipity of the Foreign Service. It turned out to have helped with some very useful connections for Dohwa later. I mean, the Norwegian, the Foreign Ministry, with the Nobel Foundation, with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Carsten Smith, who became quite a good friend of you, John, personally, and of Dohwa. So it's kind of unexpected happy consequences there.
Yeah, not to mention the Storting. That's how it's pronounced.
The parliament, right.
Had some good meetings there. You know, all in all, it's been a very, very productive and helpful relationship, not only to me personally, but for the foundation.
John, Bill just mentioned that a lot has changed since the foundation was established. What was the most important thing that you think happened in 2024 in U.S.-China relations?
The most important, if you will, standout development was the release of American prisoners who had been serving long sentences in China. Pastor David Lin, Mr. Mark Sweden, Mr. Kai Lee, and although we didn't work much on it, John Leung. It turns out that Mr. Xi and Mr. Biden met in Lima on the sidelines of the APEC summit. Now, during that, Mr. Xi said to Mr. Biden, China has four red lines that cannot be crossed. And the first, of course, is Taiwan. The second is human rights and democracy, but human rights. Third is the system, namely the Communist Party. For China's economic development, those four things. What is more crossing the red line of human rights than advocating for the release of prisoners in Chinese prisons? So there's this meeting, and then a few days later, she authorizes the release of all these prisoners. We still don't know exactly why. Bill, what the hell is going on? What happened?
It is a puzzle, John, but I did wonder if this wasn't a tantalizing incoming a gift for Trump as he came to the White House to show that they could, despite having laid down his so-called red lines, that Xi Jinping could do a deal. And as you know, from many, many decades of dealing with the Chinese in trade negotiations and commercial negotiations, everything's on the table all the time. You can trade something in export controls for a political prisoner. It's a kind of negotiating style that's quite alien, I think, to Americans. We try to keep things in our own lanes. But for the Chinese, this is absolutely standard practice. So, and of course, the general secretary, Xi Jinping, is in effect the emperor. What he says goes. But I suspect it was a kind of a dangling, tantalizing gesture that towards Trump. Trump invited Xi Jinping to the inauguration. Obviously, she wouldn't take that. But sending Han Zheng, the so-called vice president, who has no power in the political system, but could be a conduit for messages, that was a positive gesture. And perhaps Trump has reciprocated. We've got signs that Trump is prepared to try to do some sort of bargaining with Xi Jinping.
No, I agree. I think we have that going on. Also a bit of a thank you and farewell to Mr. Biden. But I think there's something else going on. And that aligns with previous practice, which Bill and I are well aware of. Back when China wanted to hold on to its most favored nation trading status, they released a lot of prisoners. So when they want something, they do something. What do they want now? Well, back then, in the early 90s, they wanted MFN. What do they want now? They want a better relationship with the United States, pure and simple. But in addition to that, okay, so after the Americans were released, Miss Mao Ning, the spokesperson of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, said that China got three of its citizens back, including a fugitive. Now, who was that? Well, as listeners know, there's something called, was it Operation Fox Hunt, at which they go after corrupt officials who are overseas. I think one of the things they got was the return to China, probably in handcuffs, of a very significant, very corrupt official who pilfered hundreds of millions of dollars from China. And that is something that Mr. Xi wants, and I think he'd pay any price to get that guy back. And I think that's my theory.
But you know, it was quite unprecedented for them to do these sorts of prisoner swaps until recently. I mean, typically, if you think back, John, to the late 90s, I mean, you mentioned MFN and all of that, when the Chinese were desperate to end congressional reviews of their human rights records before the vote on most favored nation status. And so the big trade-off with market access agreement for the U.S. was that it would bring the Chinese permanent normal trading relations. And so they would be spared this annual review. And then you had some tactical maneuvers, some things to do with UN Human Rights Commission and so on. And you had this exchange of state visits in that period with Jiang and Clinton. So he's very prominent in the Western media. Political prisoners were released as part of the sweetener for all of that, Wei Jingsheng and Wang Dan. You know, but the climate's very different now, and these sort of the prisoner swaps is, as I said before, it's unprecedented in the way they've dealt with these issues.
Donald Trump has prided himself in making deals. Do you think there will be such an emphasis on human rights in the future?
I don't know what Bill thinks on this. I think it's almost impossible to know what's in Trump's head. You know, he wants to go to China and then do a big deal. Will that include human rights? I think it's quite possible. And the reason is, of the four red lines, the only one in which China can make major concessions. Certainly, they're not going to make a concession on Taiwan. And they're not going to say, okay, Chinese Communist Party is out of the picture. So what's left? And they have an unlimited supply of political prisoners. I've learned of two more American citizens under coercive measures. You know, there are some who say, well, they release a hostage so they can take another. I wouldn't go that far. But certainly, by releasing all these people, they kind of clear the table and allow for more. I mean, basically, I think what's going to happen is that Mr. Xi will dangle some human rights concessions. That's all ears for Trump because, you know, we're out of the Human Rights Council. We're dropping out of all kinds of other, I mean, the World Health Organization. I think next will be WTO. So all of this is music to Xi's ears. He's very happy about all that. But I think it's possible that he will dangle some concessions and Trump can take credit. That's what he wants.
One possible pressure point, but to the degree you can understand Trump's thinking processes or how policy is made or not made in his Washington, you have Marco Rubio as Secretary of State, who's been a very strong proponent of human rights in China, both with the in Xinjiang with the Uyghurs and then in Hong Kong. He'll certainly, I think, advocate for action on human rights. And you said earlier, Xi Jinping has an infinite supply of people he can let out of jail. And Trump does not seem to be someone who in his public life has taken much interest in human rights questions. So it's a kind of free vote in a way.
So during his first term, Trump managed to get out an American citizen prisoner, a political prisoner, convicted of endangering state security, Sandy Fan Gillis. During the campaign, Trump was asked, will you press for the release of Jimmy Lai? And he basically said, oh, not a problem, you know. This evoked howls of angry protest from none other than John Lee himself, the chief executive of the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region. Oh, mind your own business, blah, blah, blah.
Well, we talked about prisoner releases of 2024, but kind of on the tradecraft of human rights. How do you approach these Chinese bureaucrats?
A few years ago, I drew up a list of do's and don'ts in terms of intervening on behalf of prisoners in China. The first thing is you do not insult or make personal remarks about Chinese leaders or your interlocutors. That is so important. Secondly, cite Chinese domestic law, not international law. They don't care whether or not they violate international law. Neither do we, by the way. And the other thing, one of the other things is when you produce a list to hand over to the Chinese government, remember this. Several short lists are better than one big list. Keep it short, have priorities. Oh, and by the way, here's the other thing, which I hope we've, as Doihua, have schooled these diplomats, is always make it bilingual, please, because this list will go to the prison people. Now, these are the kinds of things we have done in addition to others. We've done those things, and it's paid off, in my opinion. Since Duehua was established in 1999, we have submitted more than 500 prisoner lists with thousands of names. And we've learned of clemency, better treatment, and what have you, for several hundred.
Well, but I think, John, that just on what you said about these more specific cases and your do's and don'ts list is it just underscores how important it is that we are anyone who engages with the Chinese on human rights is extremely well prepared. Keep the list short, punchy, so that they can digest it and follow up on the cases that you've raised. But as we both found, Duehua's research into these individual cases often turns up information that the people you talk to in the Chinese bureaucracy, they themselves don't know. Because the bureaucracy is, it's not a monolith, it's a kind of thousand shades of gray. So you've got to not only know the insides and outsides of the cases you're bringing to them, but you have to know something about their own bureaucratic system. Where are we going to find, if not a sympathetic ear, at least an open ear to get this process going? And it takes more than one intervention on a case before there's enough consensus built up within the Chinese system that so and so should be released on medical parole or whatever the case may be. So it's very, very important to do your homework. And in that regard, I think the database, the political prisoner database that has been growing over these last 20 some years is an absolute treasure. That's not only a useful tool for people engaging in the practice of human rights interventions with the Chinese, but it's a kind of historical legacy that scholars will be able to use for many years to come. It's just a terribly, terribly valuable asset that the foundation has built up over all of these years.
You know, what you said about, you know, the Chinese bureaucracy is not monolithic. Absolutely the case. And you mentioned, okay, the prison service, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and they see things differently. But in my opinion, the big one is Ministry of State Security. They are top of the totem pole. And I would say Ministry of Foreign Affairs is a bit further down the totem pole. And, you know, in 2023, we announced the life sentence for the Uyghur scholar, Rahil Dawood. Now, usually I was thinking, are they going to come after Dui Hua after we've done this? You know, oh, no, not at all. In fact, I think that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs was as horrified by what had happened to Professor Rahil Dawood.
You almost could call it the Ministry of Party State Security, because in the current Ministry of State Security grew out of the party's own internal investigative arms beginning back in the 1920s. So they are absolutely the guardians of the crown jewels. When prisoners are put in the slammer on an endangering state security charge, it really means endangering the party state system. And which brings us back to Xi Jinping's fourth red line. It's the system, especially with this tremendous emphasis on security above all. So if anything, the Ministry of State Security's prominence is only increased, even in having a voice right at the table of policy formation, something absolutely unprecedented in the generations of leaders before Xi Jinping. You have to go all the way back to the Mao period to find a state security official, a voice who was as prominent as these guys are now.
Bringing us back to 2024, Bill, was there anything that stood out for you in China or the U.S.?
What struck me about last year in China was this kind of creeping malaise in the society that stemmed in part from the very severe lockdowns that they had in COVID, particularly in Shanghai, where you had the most sophisticated citizenry in the country, probably. When all of that suddenly ended without any preparation for mass vaccination or the public health messaging, and you got a million deaths at least within weeks as these variants of COVID spread. And against that, the background of the property market, in which most Chinese families have the bulk of their wealth, such as it is, it raised real questions about the regime's ability to manage the economy. And so all of this has led to, as I said earlier, a kind of a mood of malaise across the society that is quite pronounced, and very hard to see how animal spirits will be revived after that.
I really couldn't agree more on that. You know, one other thing about 2024 is that we have seen for some time, but it really peaking in 2024 and beyond, and that is the souring of foreign company feelings towards China. The annual AmCham China survey shows a record percentage of American companies considering divesting, leaving. 30% of companies are looking at leaving China. It was 20% in 2023. I know that has got the attention of the Chinese leadership, and yet they keep doing things that endanger that. Case in point is, again, the arrests of business people. People I talk to, and Bill, I'm sure you too, people are afraid to go to China. And that's deadly. Once that gets in your head, you know, watch out.
That was John Cam with Bill McCahill on the events of 2024. You can listen to that episode and all the others at www.dohua.org. Thanks again for listening to this special podcast series, Dragon Years, Remembrance of Times Past.